You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 5th of July 2014 on Monocle 24.
From food photography shoots that feed the imagination to the analysis of taste, aesthetic and gastronomic, a delectable world of covers, pages and typefaces that are almost good enough to eat. Artistic double spreads and unusual collaborations. Our weekly spread of print opportunities kicks off with gusto. We look at some tasty print morsels on The Stack this week with the editor of one title that looks at the world of food and food lovers. Plus, to one bread-mad nation that isn't scared of niche magazine titles.
We are talking to a guy from the European Space Agency about what is it to eat bakery products in space. And one thing that is very important with this is it's not allowed to have any breadcrumbs.
All that and plenty more besides coming up today on this 97th edition of The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis programme. Hello and welcome to The Stack on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards, standing in for our editor-in-chief and your usual host, Tyler Brûlé. The reason being, of course, Tyler's been out and about this week, amongst other places. He has been in a charming corner of the Alps, up in the northern Italian but German-speaking province of Südtirol. And I spoke to him a little bit earlier about the state of the magazine nation where he is.
It was a great week. We met so many fascinating people from the world of media, from business, from the political scene. And I think one of the amazing things we keep on coming back to, there's, of course, always the discussion that this is a fascinating part of Italy because, indeed, it is Italian, but it is very German. And then you also have the Ladino language. But then you have this incredible overlay of English. And we had some people on from the Free University. They were on the program on Thursday. And so one of the interesting things was there's a crash of bottles in the background. That's the remnants of our party from Thursday evening. But also when they said they were going to create this Free University in Bolzano, that it should be bilingual. And then they said, let's make it trilingual. Let's add English as an official language. So what that does to the media landscape is amazing. You go into any of the great cafes, and I'm sitting very close to one called Cafe Città right now, which is just one of those amazing classic Middle European coffee houses, which just has a bank of newspapers on sticks when you're in front of it. And they have things like the Dolomiten and Alto Adige, but then you've got the Neue Zürcher Zeitung and the Frankfurter Allgemeine, and then as much as then you see Le Monde and you see the Financial Times and the International New York Times, etc. And that just makes it sort of very vibrant and true cafe culture.
Now, Tyler, we should, of course, remind our listeners that there'll be lots more about Südtirol, of course, in the survey that we're doing there. What are the key themes? Is it going to reflect this multilingual quality? Is it going to reflect the interesting sort of spirit of entrepreneurialism that there is in the area?
Well, hopefully most of our listeners and indeed readers have received the survey by now. I'm sure there are a couple of corners of the world where maybe our July-August issue has not quite hit yet. I think we try to do two things, Tom. It is very much a survey that looks at tourism, but we've tried to do it in a way which is slightly business-to-business because we want to also inspire people who are going to read around the world to think, oh, maybe this is an interesting area that I could invest in. If I'm an investor from Korea or Japan, should I look at actually buying a property here and doing something interesting? If you are in the F&B business, would you maybe want to actually come to the region to look for talent and chefs as much as sort of produce? So there is the B2B component. Of course, then we also have, I think, much more of a B2C side to it as well, which is, of course, also interesting. Just if Tom Edwards wants to take a summer holiday, where might he go?
Well, I think Südtirol, the card is marked now, Tyler, without any doubt.
Well, we have to sort of line up, what mountaintop will you go to? Where are you going to be dining in the evening? And of course, where will you be laying your head every evening?
Lovely stuff. And Tyler, just a final thought then. I know you've been writing a little bit about this in your FT column, and you've been talking, we always catch up actually, about the general kind of state of newsstand. Any additional reflections then from your week in Südtirol?
Last week, anyone who caught my column in the FT last week was actually just talking about the evaporation of newsstands and bookstores at a lot of airports around the world. There is a healthy and strong media scene here, no question, but And I think this is one of the fascinating things. Anyone who's interested in startups, and really we're talking sort of startup at street level, there are quite a few empty shops and vacant spaces in the city. I mean, not in a sad way, but you just oh God, that's a really sort of fantastic corner space you see. And I've been thinking that maybe it won't be us, Tom, but there's room for someone to come in here and do a very, very good international newsstand.
Tyler Brûlé, Monocle's editor-in-chief. Thanks, as always, for joining us. This time from Sud Tyrol, and we'll see you, I'm sure, back on the stack very soon. You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Now, here in Studio One of Midori House, I'm delighted to say I'm joined by my guest today. It's the creative director of the Gourmand magazine. Since launching in 2012, the stunningly designed title has pleased and delighted magazine lovers in London and far beyond with its refined compositions and alternative editorial angles. With the recently published issue 4 of the Gourmand in his hand, fresh off the presses, it's a warm welcome back to the stack to David Lane. David, thanks as always for joining us here on the programme. Let's do a bit of a state of the nation for food magazines, this kind of thing. Where are we at? Still a kind of a part of the magazine scene that's as vibrant and as exciting as when we last spoke?
I think so, yeah, definitely. I mean, there's increasingly more and more titles, and I think there's room for lots. I think I probably said this before, but it is the most universal subject in the world, and considering that, it's still fairly underrepresented in print media, and there's room for every single one to have its own angle, really. So lots of the new magazines that are starting up are taking their own kind of little niche. Yeah,
exciting times. And amongst your stack of magazines that you have today, I gather we have the almost brand new Gourmand as well.
In some parts of the world, it's probably brand new because it's taken a bit longer to get there.
Takes a while.
In London, it's not as brand new.
Nearly
brand
new.
But it's fairly fresh off the press. This one's got a paw print on it because it's from my coffee table. My cat sat on it. But other than that,
I always think that adds a little bit of extra character.
Pristine.
As well. Let's start by talking a little bit then about issue 4. Is this correct?
Yeah, it's issue 4. Well, it's actually issue 5. This is the constant confusion. It's number 4. We did a 0.
That's right.
Which was a pilot, really, which was a great idea at the time.
This is terribly complicated for someone
when you're
now
explaining to a shop who's ordering something. It's not such a good idea.
And tell me a little bit about then issue 4/5. Any particular unique challenges or delights?
I can quickly whiz through a few bits of content because it probably would explain better.
I noticed a lot of cats, speaking of paw print.
There is one piece with cats. It's cats and food. And it's an incredible set designer and an amazing cat caster stroke Gourmand editor, who's not me, the other one, and a brilliant chef and food stylist called Ian Graham. And we've been talking for a while about, we all had cats and the kind of ideal things they'd like to eat, and we forged this idea to create the most kind of fantastical cat feasts. But it's quite serious. We didn't want to do kind of lol cats, although I'm sure the internet will love it.
Yeah.
So Peter is eating a vanilla panna cotta, but it's shaped exactly like a milk carton.
And he's quite a stylish fellow there, I think.
Yeah, that's my cat, thank you.
Oh, is it? Yeah. Oh, there you go.
Florence has got a wood pigeon sundae. Spritz has got a gurnard jelly. It's kind of surreal. There's a lobster gatto and some real sugar mice.
Wow, big eyes on that cat there.
Yeah, this is Laura Weir, who's another magazine person. That's her cat, and Iggy got lost in the studio for quite a long time. It was very traumatic.
But I suppose you had sugar mice to lure him back out.
It didn't work, actually. And we thought we might have to not publish the shoot because the cat died. It was all awful. We were running around the street, going into other people's houses, stealing their cats.
It ended happily in the end.
Finally, Tom, who works with us, put his hand behind the shower with a mobile phone. And there's a brilliant photo with two tiny ears emerging behind all these pipes. So we unscrewed the shower and got him out. There's Faye Mashler, amazing food critic and writer, and we went to her house, and there's a piece about
lovely portraits,
the objects that she has and some of the stories about her, really. We thought it was nice to do that about somebody who offers opinion on lots of other people. Not that we're really offering opinion, it's very much in her words.
Well, let me just ask you about that in particular, because it's interesting you said about the sort of universality of food. Food writing, though, can be a little more divisive, can't it? And you can really, I guess, upset people. Certainly food critics find this a constant problem. Have you found that to be an issue producing The Gourmand? You know, did you get sort of love mail and hate mail in equal measure? Or do you find it, because it's magazine territory, it's maybe a bit easier to offer up opinions and they don't seem to divide in quite that same way?
We intentionally don't review restaurants. So that's not to say we don't have opinions on things. Mm. I think it's very important to have opinions on things if you're publishing stuff.
I think it helps, definitely.
But, I mean, there are, not to kind of moan about other publications, but there are lots of beautiful publications which seem quite void of a kind of any sort of opinion, but look and feel lovely. So I think that's important. But in terms of restaurant reviews, we definitely don't do it. We write about restaurants. So there's a piece in here about Simon Hopkinson, who's really kind of the father of the sort of London British food scene that Fergus and Mark Hicks and all those people are very much part of, and his restaurant Bibendum. So it's about, you know, the shoot happened in the space, and it's about his opinions on things, but we don't really want to say whether we think
like the food or
salmon's
not.
Good or not.
Yeah.
We'll kind of leave that to other people. I think generally with restaurant reviews, I do think people should go out of their way to find good places, because that's what I'd like to read about. When people go a long way to lay into someone for not having a good place, I do find it a bit of a waste of column inches, personally.
So that's The Gourmand, a very exciting time. And I think it's going from strength to strength, which is always good to see, of course, for some of our favourite, you know, our friend titles. We love to see that. Why don't we delve elsewhere, though, into your stack of magazines? You've got sure. What I like to see a variety of content, themes, but also formats. And you've got quite a wide range of things here. Where shall we start?
So I did just bring the last five things I've bought or picked up, because one of them's free. One of them is debatable whether it is a magazine or not. So it's Ambit, but it's actually a publication that accompanied an exhibition about Eduardo Paolozzi. And it's designed by John Morgan, and it's a collection of all of his works that appeared in Ambit magazine previously. But the format is exactly the same. And it's interspersed with some of the original advertising and some of the other original features from the magazines that
this is a nostalgic treat right there.
Originally.
Definitely.
So it's a kind of nerdy, magazine-y magazine. And it's also beautifully designed. It's got kind of glowing edged fluorescent plastic cover with screen printing on it and little hidden booklets in the back printed on nice coloured paper. And it's kind of a feast of colour and style, like Paolozzi's pieces. So
that is a beautiful thing. I'm very, very happy that you brought that one in. That's David Lane, and we'll continue to delve into David's stack of magazines in just a moment as we continue here on The Stack. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Now we head to Germany, where a brand new title offers a glimpse into an important slice of the country's life. Launched at the end of May, Brot, which is German for bread, of course, is a lifestyle quarterly dedicated to all things doughy. Brot is a collaboration between Jahr Top Special Verlag, a publisher of hobby titles, and the German Bakers Association. It will be sold at news kiosks and bookstores, and of course in participating bakeries, appropriately enough. But does Brot have a recipe for success? Susan Stone has this report from Berlin.
Walk down just about any street in most German cities and you'll pass multiple opportunities to buy bread. From bakeries, corner shops, organic food stores, even newsstands. A sandwich on a bakery roll is the top takeout food in the country, selling a cut above fast food of any sort. It's not just pretzels and pumpernickel. At the Bäumer Lütem Bakery in Prenzlauer Berg, sales manager Rebecca Jans tells me they have 35 types of bread. That's just counting their classic German loaves. Round, square, long and short, sourdough, wholemeal, wheat, spelt and rye. Including rolls, baguettes and buns, the number is closer to 100. Bäumer Lütem is also organic and sustainable, which extends to the recycling of bread.
Was 50 Roggen und 50 Weizen ist, da kommt bei uns noch geröstetes Brot mit drin.
The house specialty is something unusual. Unsold bread is toasted, crumbled, and stirred into a sourdough mix of wheat and rye. It's the kind of bread-centric ingenuity intrinsic to German life.
Bread is something of which is deeply rooted in the German culture. I think it's the German food, and there was no magazine about that.
Thorsten Höger is the editor of Brot.
We have around 3,000 different kinds of breads in Germany right now. And this is mainly because Germany was split up into quite a lot of states. And every state had its own bread, different to other countries like, for example, France, which was for a very long time one unified country, where you had one culture, something like this. We had quite a lot of different cultures in Germany. And so out of this, there came quite a lot of different kinds of bread, and you're recognizing this still today.
Choosing a topic near and dear to Germans' hearts and stomachs is a good start, but there are many cooking magazines already on the market. Brot is different, says Höger. It's not about recipes.
So what we are doing is quite a lot of reporting about bakeries, about strange places where you can eat bakery products. Like, for example, we are talking to a guy from the European Space Agency about what it is it to eat bakery products in space. And one thing that is very important with this is it's not allowed to have any breadcrumbs.
Another feature looks at the wild bakers who bake massive loaves in industrial ovens. You might call them stunt bakers. There are also tips from top chefs and a heated discussion about organic bread, which raised eyebrows at Berlin's Bäumer Lütum. The all-organic bakery opted out of featuring the new publication. Brot is partly funded by the commercially oriented German Bakers Association, but Thorsten Höger says they have no editorial oversight.
The bakers definitely want to polish the image with the magazine, but of course this will only work when you have an independent magazine that reports independently on the bakery, like we are doing with the story on is organic better or is it not so, which is definitely controversial.
From outside, the German magazine market looks as healthy as full grain. Subscription prices are high and new titles seem to launch every month.
The number of magazines is still rising, yes, but the circulation of each magazine is shrinking. You have quite a lot of more niche market magazines that exist only because there's somebody who really wants to do this magazine, but who's not going to earn quite a lot of money with it.
The printed word may be flourishing here, but the baking world is losing its steam. The number of bakeries in Germany is dropping, and the German Bakers Association is taking action. As well as helping to fund Brot, the association is launching a baking reality show, one of three planned for German TV this year. It has even applied for UNESCO cultural recognition for its baking traditions. Still, will Brot find a readership hungry for more? I asked Höger who he thinks will buy the magazine.
To be honest, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. It could be me. I'm going to the bakery every Saturday with my kids, and I'm responsible on the weekend for buying the bread. I'm interested in bread as well. Could be somebody who's 60s, could be somebody who's 20. I don't know. There are quite a lot of men who are also baking. It's not a typical woman magazine, and we are with the layout of the magazine, we are trying to have it neutral. Not quite a very hard or a very soft layout, but something in between, so that we can reach as well men as well as women as well with the magazine.
The first edition of the 100-page magazine has a print run of 80,000 copies and a cover price of €5.90. Brot boasts high-quality paper and rich imagery. The content comes mainly from freelancers. Höger hopes to put out 4 issues of Brot a year. The next one is scheduled for the holiday season, a perfect time for baking, and another chance to become the toast of the town. For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Susan Stone.
Dankeschön.
That was Susan Stone reporting on the launch of Brot magazine in Berlin. Still with me on the stack and listening intently to that was David Lane. David, interesting, just to get a flavour, as it were, of the both the sort of the market for bread and the market for magazines in Berlin and, well, across Germany. It's certainly a pretty vibrant and thriving magazine market. But there were some interesting points there about, you know, a preponderance of titles, but maybe the numbers dwindling for each. I mean, is that a fair characterization across the board? I mean, surely there are some who are still going from strength to strength, aren't there?
100% sure. I mean, all the recent titles that are run by people that I know, naturally increase with every issue as their circulation and sort of exposure increases. I think there are lots of bigger titles that kind of rely on the traditional model of just selling lots of advertising and not worrying about selling many magazines and just putting thousands of them out there, that the readership probably is falling and probably falling faster than the small ones are growing. But I think it's not as black and white as that.
Possibly not. And interesting just to look at these sorts of titles that are funded by, whether it's the German Bakers Association or a fashion label. Where do you stand on that? Because I guess if it doesn't trammel the editorial reach of the magazine, then it's kind of fine. Are you a bit of a skeptic about that? Are you happy for that involvement? Because it just means more magazines and frankly, who cares how they're financed? Where do you stand on that sort of side of
things? I mean, I think every publication has always been run by people that have an agenda, and whether that agenda is attached to a business or it's attached to politics or it's attached to, you know, baking. It's kind of, I think that's the sort of role of a publication. As long as it's honest about it, I think it's fine. I think you know almost more when something says Acne paper that it's Acne that's doing it and that content is celebrating what they do than perhaps when you pick up a magazine that's sort of seemingly independent and actually a lot of the content is funded by brands.
Let's continue to delve then through your stack of magazines. Where should we head next?
I did bring in the new issue of Dazed because to talk about really what they've done, which is interesting and maybe more about publishing in general, they made a conscious decision with this issue to go bi-monthly rather than monthly and put a lot more effort into their online content. And the result has meant that the magazine is sort of clear of all those little things that should really now live online. And I really like it. It's been redesigned as well, and it's a bit cleaner. You can read it now, which in the past, some of the stuff was like, as well as it was written, the design was a little bit inhibitive of reading. So that's great. And as always, the kind of visuals are good too. But I thought it was just, it was very interesting that they decided to sort of preempt that and make it into a conscious decision rather than just not printing as many.
I mean, it's an interesting point, I guess, about, I guess, clarity of sort of editorial direction. And you say losing to online some things that live better, if you like, in that realm. Do you think that's still a bit of a conflict that some publishers are struggling to reconcile themselves with? And admittedly, maybe some may not go bi-monthly rather than monthly. That's a pretty sort of direct way of doing that. But if that is a bit of a battle and a bit of a conflict, how would you gauge the success or failure of some publishers to deal with it? Do you think some people are still a bit unsure, frankly, about how to balance that?
I mean, my personal opinion is that the sort of short form content just does better live online. It's kind of how you digest it. You know, I look on my phone at publications in the morning and you can look at like 10 short things and flick through some images and scroll on some stuff. You know, it's quite expensive to put magazines out in the world on paper. And if you're doing it, I always think it's nicer if the content that lives in them is a bit more long form, a bit more researched, a bit more kind of considered. I think that also leads to the fact that you're more likely to keep it. You know, it's more likely to be timeless. So I think there are people struggling to find that place. Probably they're publications that have just always had such a strict formula and that's how their advertising sales are based and everything is kind of locked into it, that it's quite hard to change that. I mean, like, especially newspapers, you know, if you picked up a newspaper and it was just full of 2,000 word essays, you wouldn't really think of it as being a newspaper, but it'd be interesting to see in 10 years time if they actually are, and they do come out once a week and it's more, you know, research reporting and it's not kind of lots of tweet length pieces about what celebrity fell out of a car the night before.
So it appears to be going that way, doesn't it, with more curated, a bit more analytical, certainly in the press market. Let's continue on, though. Beneath cool. Days, you have another. This is probably, is this the weightiest of your
magazines? It's definitely the weightiest.
Magazines this week.
There's a gallery in Amsterdam called Foam, which is a photography gallery, and they publish a magazine, which I used to subscribe to, and I stopped, because I stopped thinking it was as good as it used to be. And I just picked this one up, and I thought I shouldn't have stopped, actually, because it's really good. So,
and is that intrigues me, because I'm always interested in how magazine aficionados consume their magazine media. Is it a case of sort of familiarity breeding contempt almost, or is it just that you feel you need that detachment almost to come back and look at something with fresh eyes?
I found that it become so incredibly designed and every possible type of paper was used in it and format and folding and everything that you weren't really looking at the images. You were kind of just looking at a designer's sort of self-indulgent splurge.
Surely not.
I mean, which, as a design reference, it was beautiful, but I found it was slightly getting in the way of the content. But it's found a really good balance now. Maybe there's new designers, I'm not sure. It's just a portfolio magazine, really. There's not a huge amount of writing in it. The writing's very good, but it's more just introducing kind of like 10 contemporary portfolios. And they're all really good. And it's printed brilliantly by Lecturis, who also print The Gourmand.
And I was going to say, in terms of you talking about sort of, you know, paper stocks and maybe doing more than was necessary to sort of make a point, but the balance looks maybe pretty good now. Do you think they've reined back on some of that? Or
I think they've kept that. It's why it's got this kind of exposed bind. Each section is a different paper, and they work closely with a paper company cleverly to sort of showcase different papers, and the photographers have an input into which papers used for their piece. But it seems to have found the right balance now, where it's quite clear that one essay is just very simple. I mean, this one I'm looking at now is presented just with a blank page on every other page. There's a bit more space. In terms of like consuming contemporary photography and not reading vast amounts about the context of it, just sort of keeping up to date with what people are doing in the art world, it's really interesting and it's put together very well.
Good stuff. Well, I enjoyed that. What a thing of beauty that is. Well, we're almost at the end. Let's just kind of finish by returning then to The Gourmand. Tell us, can you sort of tantalise us with any future developments that will be exciting? Or are you going to keep your cards pretty close to your chest?
Definitely. We're doing a lot more content. We're redoing the website. There's going to actually, interestingly, be more online content and a very obvious separation between print and online. We've just been making some films. There's one previewing this week, which is about cocktails.
Lovely.
It's a sort of alternative to happy presenter food television.
That sounds good. I'm always happy to delve, literally and metaphorically, into the world of cocktails, of course. Exciting stuff, David. You'll have to keep us posted and obviously visit us again very soon.
Definitely.
When the next issue is. Even.
Yeah, and there's lots more in this issue other than cats. That's probably the least...
and we should remind, if listeners have joined us during the show, that's cats and their recipes, not recipes involving... cats.
There's amazing pieces about archaeology of alcohol and incredible restaurants and haggis and Peru and all sorts of brilliant stuff.
What's not to enjoy? Cats and haggis on the pages of the same magazine. David Lane from The Gourmand, thank you very much as always for joining us here on The Stack.
Thank you.
And that is all we have time for on this 97th edition of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. A special thanks to my guest, David Lane, of course, to our producer, David Pleasant, and our studio manager here in London, Claire Urban. Any comments or queries, as ever, get in touch. info@monocle.com is the email address you need. And don't forget, we'll be back at the same time next Saturday here at Midori House in London. You can listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes or SoundCloud. But that's all for this week's edition of The Stack. From me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye.